Hello, listeners. This is your host, Ryan. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed our first couple episodes, you may have noticed that we were on a little bit of a hiatus. But even though we weren't posting episodes, we were still recording them. So we have a bunch of really great episodes with some really great guests saved up. This episode, my guest is Kermit Apio, who is a comedian that I greatly admire. And as I was going through my archive of recordings, I saw this one and knew that I wanted to record it or to post it as soon as possible. We recorded this back in October of 2012, I believe. We had him in town to do a show that a week before, but he didn't have time to sit down and do the podcast. So a week later, he was on the road, and he actually went out of his way to come back through Bend just so he could do this podcast. And not only did that mean a lot to me, but saying that he's a professional and a gentleman just doesn't even come close to doing him justice. And of course, after listening to this podcast, you'll hopefully have the exact same opinion of him. So please enjoy. Silence your cell phone.
Okay.
All right, there we go. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I am sitting here with Kermit Apio.
Hello.
Welcome.
Well, glad to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Happy to do it.
We did a gig together a week ago.
Yes.
And you just happened to be coming back through town.
Yes.
And it just happened to be the same week that I decided to restart my podcast. What are the odds?
Wow. Look at me. Timing it all right so I could be here.
Yeah, I know. I'm so glad that you came back through town. And I'm sorry that I wasn't able to see your show, but I was doing the open mic.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. You saw it a week before. Trust me. It hasn't changed all that much.
I'm sure it's the same thing.
Like there's all this new material since the last time.
That's my dog out there. We're out on Trouble Ranch right now. A whole lot of acreage and animals in the middle of nowhere.
Apparently a raccoon's going to die.
Yeah. No, I just saw the neighbor going across their field in their golf cart. I think that's what my dog's barking.
Oh, okay. They drive golf carts around?
Yeah. Well, it's a tree nursery over there.
Oh. So,
and the guy who owns it is kind of an older guy.
Oh, I see.
And I'm not going to give our address, so hopefully we won't get in trouble, but he has a lot of southern people working over there, like far southern people. So he has them do all the work, and he just kind of goes around
in the golf cart.
Yeah, in the golf cart just to check up on everything. But yeah, and well, if we had a golf cart here, I'd be driving that around all the time.
Of course,
but we're more redneck. We have four wheelers and whatnot.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, it's great to have you here. I'm very excited about this. When you're coming into town, and I was hosting the show, my friend Adam Eagle showed me a clip of some of your work because I'd never seen you live before.
Right.
And the joke that I saw was the hitting on the bank teller.
Right.
I was laughing so hard during that. Like,
oh, thanks.
Because, and we were talking about this last night, about how the jokes that you have, I love your jokes because they're so well written that anybody could read them and people would laugh. But the nuances and the inflections that you put on it make it 1,000 times better because it's subtle, but then you have just those little things that just really add to your comedy.
Oh, thanks. You know, when I watch comedians that I like, one of the things I start to realize is that they have pure commitment to the bit because you have a sense that there's always a sense in you that you wonder if the joke's going to fail, right? You worry about it and you hope it doesn't fail. And I started noticing that the comedians that really were making it at a big level and the ones that I really liked watching, you couldn't see that in them. You couldn't see that there was any sense that the joke was going to fail.
Yeah.
It was more like you were sitting at dinner with them and they were telling you a story that happened to them or giving you an opinion about something they felt, you know? Mm-hmm. And
yeah, they're not doing it for laughs. They're doing it just to tell you something.
Or at least that's the way it seems. I mean, ultimately, they are doing it for laughs. Yeah. But you're right. The outgoing feeling is that I just want to tell you this about it and see if you relate to it. And that's when I started realizing that, okay, I've got these jokes and they're pretty decent, but in the delivery of them, is there a way that number one I could let people know I have some confidence in it as if I was telling them a story at dinner. Mm-hmm. And number two, Can I illustrate the bit? You know, can make give the bit more life, and that's kind of where it started to come out of. And then, can I do it my own way? Can I do it in a way that's unique to me? And so that's what I've been working on is really getting to the point of making bits my own. Like you said, I mean, it's great when you write a joke and it's a good joke, but it's another thing when you can make that joke something that uniquely is yours. Mm-hmm. That even if someone else did that joke, it might get less, but it wouldn't have the same feeling that you know the way I do it.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully. I mean, that's really that's what I'm hoping for more than what I do. You know what I mean? Like, this is more what I strive for.
How would you describe yourself? Like, what type of comedy do you think? Like, where do you want to fit, and where do you think you fit?
Yeah. See, that's the problem. A lot of times when people, again, you know, tell me, can you describe your act? I'm literally the most boring type of description in a comedy act, I think. Yeah. You know what I mean? In my opinion. Because if you describe most comics, there's some kind of like sort of way to describe it that is really interesting. In mine, it's incredibly autobiographical. It really is all about my life and things or things that I'm reacting to in my life. Mm-hmm. And that's so like, well, really? So you, sounds like fun. You know what I mean? Like, just describing my act sounds boring. But
well, and see, that's what I was saying is that like your jokes are really well written, so anybody could read them. So it could be very flat, but you can still get laughs from it. Like with George Carlin, I read some of his books, and when you're reading his books, you're just like, okay, well, this is interesting. But the only way that I was able to actually laugh out loud at it is to picture him doing it on stage himself.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And, yeah, but like I said with you, it's just that because it's personal. It's you. That's those are your things, and you make them your own.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, it's one of those things where you could walk by something at Costco a million times, and then one day they have it out for free sample.
Yeah.
And you try it and you go, man, that's really good. You know, I'm going to have some of that. And you buy a bag.
Yeah.
Right? And that's kind of where, for me, when people say, you know, bookers or whatever, so well, tell me what do you think your act is? And it's autobiographical. It's a guy in his 40s, you know, dealing with kind of who he is and who he's becoming and the realities of that. And it's clean. Like, well, that is such a mundane, you know, I mean, when you look at it that way. But like you said, if you come see it, then maybe there's something that's sort of unique and not groundbreaking unique. I realize I don't push any envelopes, but at least something that may be different than most comics you'll see if you go to comedy regularly, right?
Yeah.
That even though I am a clean comic, even though I am a guy who talks a lot about family and parenthood, that even if you're in your 20s and you like edgier comedy and you don't have kids, you might find something there that you might enjoy. You might find a way to relate to what I'm doing in a way. So, and that's really important to me. So, yeah, it's an interesting question to ask because it's really hard to describe what I do without sounding like, well, I've seen that a million times, you know.
Well, do you think that you have a specific audience type?
Yes, to some extent. I mean, I try and relate as much as I can.
Yeah.
But certainly, you know, over 35 is kind of where I am in a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. For a long time, I shouldn't say that. For a long time, I was, you know, not getting as many college gigs. And I told my college agent, you know, the window's closing on these because all of a sudden I was in my mid 30s and just not relating to college kids. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I get it, you know, because, you know, when I was about 30, I could still kind of hang with them a bit, you know, and it was fun and everything as far as how the material related. But then, you know, all of a sudden when my daughter was born, I was 34. My life is completely different. I'm a married dad. I haven't been in college for, you know, 14 years or whatever it was. And now I'm actually starting to get more college gigs again. Not a ton, but I'm still getting a few of them because now I'm like their dad. I'm that goofy dad. The goofy things your dad does, that's what I do, and that's what I'm talking about tonight. Yeah. And so I reframe the jokes. And I'll actually, you know... make them aware that, you know, I drive this purple Taurus wagon and how, you know, don't worry, you know, when you're a dad, it doesn't embarrass you. I know I said, and I'll say, I know it embarrasses you guys, but it doesn't embarrass me.
Yeah.
And so they can look at it from another perspective, which is, oh, this guy's as goofy as my dad is, or he does the same things my goofy dad does. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's really one of those things where you try to relate to everybody, but yeah, generally, over 35 is pretty much my crowd now.
Okay.
And then because I work clean, there is a sort of conservative, aspect to people who really like me, you know, mm-hmm. Which is weird because in a lot of ways, you know, I'm sort of, as far as personal opinion, very different from a lot of them, but I like clean comedy. And so yeah. I don't have to, you know, shove my opinions in everybody's face every day.
Did you start out clean or did you have to work into that?
I was relatively clean. I had a couple of, swear words. I never wanted to use swear words like just gratuitously. Because I don't talk that way, right? A lot of comics just have them in setups and they just, you know, to me that was like wasting time, you know.
Yeah.
Any word, whether it's a swear word or the or and or whatever you say, whatever comes out of your mouth, any extra words that don't need to be there are killing your punchline.
Yes.
The shorter the setup, the better.
Yeah.
So I never did it in the setups. And I had, I think, two or three jokes that had like a, you know, and I still have words now. Like I still have, you know, hell and damn and, you know, and so it's not like I avoid everything, but and then I had, I can't remember if I had a couple of kind of sexual bits, but nothing major.
Yeah.
And it really did get to the point where like, why am I doing these? Why am I doing these five bits? And I realized, well, because I want to get laughs and I'm in tough one-nighters and I needed them, you know?
Yeah.
And so there's a bit about, strip clubs that I don't do as much anymore, but I can actually still do that joke now for most audiences. Cause it's a relatively clean joke,
yeah.
But it's about strip clubs.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, and did you, well, when you started out and you were somewhat clean, did you think, hey, I need to be clean? Or was it just, you just didn't have that kind of writing personality?
No, you know what it was? I'm inherently lazy. It was a way to kind of, because I realized that some of my favorites, like, I've always been a huge Steve Martin fan, Gary Shandling, Letterman. I always loved Letterman. And so, but what I noticed is even though they had edge, they didn't, like Shandling swears in his act occasionally, but it wasn't the mainstay of what he does.
Yeah.
And Shandling hardly did any sexual stuff in his show. And I remember seeing him live. He did an hour and a half at a theater in Seattle. This is back in 91. I think I was him, hour and a half. Like I said, he dropped a couple F-bombs and whatnot, but wasn't really anything sexual. And if there was, it was really sort of, I don't know how to explain it, but it was like sexual topics, but sort of like not dirty in a way.
Yeah.
You know, and it was, I didn't know how he was doing that. But anyway, so getting back to what you're asking. For me, I realized that the comics I liked worked a certain way. And I also realize that when you get into these one-nighters and these hard gigs, there's a certain amount of smoke and mirrors you can do to kind of get them.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to. These bar gigs are hard, man, especially when you're opening. When you're opening those gigs, man, they will chew you up. Not just because it's a difficult room. It's not set up for comedy. You know, there's some people aren't even facing you. The TVs are on showing a baseball game. There's so much to deal with at that first level of going on the road that you have to do it. You have to do to survive,
mm-hmm.
right? And also too, people who have come to these shows before assume the first guy is bad.
Yeah.
The first guy sucks. We're not going to like him. They're convinced. You have to literally undo that before you even start getting laughs. And so you have to do what you have to do. But what I realized is that if I wanted to go farther, if I wanted to be half decent at comedy, I couldn't use any smoke and mirrors. I had to figure out what, for me, the bit was about. You know, what was important about the bit and try and figure out. So it was being clean, working clean was a way to make me work harder. That's all it was. It was a way to challenge myself to put in the work. Because up until comedy, I didn't put in the work in anything. I had never, ever cared about anything like I did comedy. I was just skating through life and, you know, doing everything to the point of, you know, being average to good at it.
Yeah.
I never wanted to be really good at anything. And so it was the first time I thought, well, you know what? I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to love this. And for a year, it's going to be everything. I'm going to go to open mics. I'm going to hang out. I'm going to write. I'm going to do everything. And then a year from now, I'm going to see two people playing ping pong. And I'm going to go, hey, what are you guys doing? And I'm going to go there and I'm going to start playing ping pong. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I knew what I was up to. But I really loved it. I loved the friends I made around open mic. I loved going up in front of strangers and hearing them laugh at something I said.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of a way for me to set it up. So, and it worked. It worked. It really, like, I started to really enjoy what I was writing, mm-hmm. you know, because I was writing it for the sake of the joke, not for how can I get a laugh out of this. It was more like, well, I find this funny.
Yeah.
And it really sort of opened up a lot.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm glad I did it that way. But yeah, it wasn't that I'm prudish or I like only clean humor. I love all kinds of comedy.
Yeah.
I just found a way to make myself work harder.
Well, and what we were saying earlier, there's a difference between your, you know, home club persona and your road persona. Because, I mean, when you are performing at the same club every week and people are coming back because they really like you, then they already know your personality.
Right.
So you don't have to explain anything about yourself. You can just go straight into your material. But then when you're on the road, people have no idea who you are or what type of humor you do.
Right.
So you have to kind of give them this intro and work into it, and you have to lead them to your comedy kind of deal. Does that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, but then again, then you sort of reach a point where you stubbornly say, well, this is kind of what my sense of humor is. Mm-hmm. And I remember working with a guy I'd never worked with before. And the first night he watched me, the second night he watched me, and he said, can I ask you something? I said, yeah. He goes, what do you do on those Friday late shows when they're drunk and they're rowdy and everything? I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, what do you do? Do you have like a whole B act that has a lot of really dirty and, you know, and do you talk about other stuff? And I said, no. I said, there's a couple jokes I'll do, but only because they're maybe just a tad edgier, but I don't have anything really different from what you've been watching. Mm-hmm. And he goes, and so what do you do? What do you do when they're really rowdy? And I just kind of went, oh, I realized what I said. Well, I sink with the ship. I let it fall.
Yeah.
And you know what? And the thing, because here's what I learned. You can make jokes about the situation. If you can make jokes about how bad the situation is, there's some people that are really going to enjoy that part of it, because they'll at least go, well, at least he knows he's not doing well, you know, and that's mm-hmm. kind of funny. And I've gotten good at like coming up with lines for that situation. And then the other part of it is, there's going to be anywhere from, you know, a handful to quite a few people who will come up to me afterwards and go, we really like what you did. You know, sorry about all that. You know, and I'll apologize to them. Like, well, sorry you had to, you know, listen to those guys scream at me or talk to each other and everything.
It doesn't matter which side of the microphone you are. That person is being annoying.
Yeah. And so if you address that and still try and do your show, there are people who are going to say, hey, we thought that guy was funny.
Yeah.
It just wasn't a great show.
Yeah.
And I'd rather have that than to, you know, do shots with them and do tequila jokes and tell them they're my buddies and do jokes about sex. And I'd rather have the handful of people that really like what I do. Now, granted, now I will say this though, being a headliner for a few years, you can have that cockiness, right? I mean, if you're the opener in these gigs and you're trying to become a headliner and you're trying to become a co-headliner, it's hard to say that. It's hard to say, look, I'm going to stick to my guns, you know, because you just need to get the gigs. You need stage time. You need to get better. So you don't want to piss off any bookers. So I say this with every sense of cockiness, because I've been around long enough that you know, I'm allowed a certain amount of leeway, that even if this gig goes, look, you're just, you know, we like comics edgier, which I've had before. I've had them tell me, like, you're too clean for us. Yeah. Our audiences won't like you. I'm cool. I'll walk away. And so I understand that what I'm saying is kind of like, as an opener, you can't be saying that. You can't say, look, I do what I do. Because then they go, all right, then you're not going to work here.
Yeah.
Okay. You
know? As a clean comic, like, when I started out doing comedy, I was uncomfortable being dirty. Like, I have, you know, jokes about masturbating, but like the subject matter is crude, but I don't use use a lot of vulgar language. Right. And when I started out, the reason was because I was just wasn't comfortable doing it on stage. And then once I realized that it's harder to be a clean comic than it is to be a dirty comic because there's restrictions on it, I didn't fight that urge to stay clean.
Right, right.
So do you – you said there's still people that will – deny you a show because you're too clean.
Yeah. How often do you understand that? Because they book rough gigs. They book, you know, or their clubs, even if it's comedy clubs, sometimes they have a rougher audience. And I get it. I mean, yeah. I did a guest set for a guy, and I won't say where it was, but he came to me afterwards. He goes, man, I love what you do. And so I'm like, oh, well, thank you very much. He goes, yeah. But there's no way I could hire you.
Oh, wow.
And I said, oh, really? He goes, man, these audiences would just, they'd be mad at me, not yeah. just you. I started laughing. And he goes, please, I hope you understand. I go, no, I totally understand. He goes, man, I like what you're so clever and you're dry. And he goes, but dry does not go over.
Yeah.
And he said, the one thing I've learned is that when I try and book my sense of humor, half the time they get mad. They don't like it.
Yeah.
And so he said, so I've learned I got to book their sense of humor because we got a business to run. We got drinks to sell. We got tickets to, you know,
yeah.
sell. And I totally understood what he said. But, man, talk about a turnaround. The guy goes, yeah, I really like your stuff. Oh, awesome. Like, man, he turned me around in one sentence.
Yeah, you're really great. I think you're great. Yeah. You're the best. You're the bee's knees. But the audience will tear yeah. you a new one in seconds.
But you're not good for us, so bye-bye.
Wow.
Yeah, but that's fine because as hard as that was to take, and then we had a nice conversation about other stuff, about life afterwards, and he was a nice guy. But as hard as it was to take, in the big picture of it, I realized, okay, then I'm doing something right. Mm-hmm. Then I'm doing something where it's not going to work everywhere, and that's fine because there's only a handful of comics that can work everywhere. Generally, comics find their audience.
Yeah.
And that's I think really more important. Seinfeld had a way of working to everybody, even dirty comedy fans and dirty comics like Seinfeld, because they realize,
oh, yeah.
this is really good. This is quality, and you can tell there's work involved. You can tell he busts his butt on these things. Mm-hmm. Each joke was just designed pieces of art. But he's the exception. You know, mm-hmm. most comics find their audience, and that can build a career. And so when things like that happen, you know, like I said, you reach a point where you're headlining so you can be a little cocky. And yes, I'm bummed they didn't hire me. I would love to work that club. But if I'm sticking to my guns and believing what I'm doing and I feel like I'm getting better, as long as I feel like I'm improving, mm-hmm. then it's okay to lose a gig because of that.
Yeah.
You know.
Interesting. Well, I have a lineup of questions that I ask comics.
Okay.
So I will – these are my Inside the Actor Studio, sort of the 10 questions.
Oh, do I have to think about what kind of tree I am?
Yeah. What is your favorite curse word?
I know. Some of those are fun, but, man, every week some of those questions are like, I hate this question.
Yeah. So there's some questions just don't apply to the people that they're talking to.
Yeah, right, exactly. There's no context.
Yeah. All right, well, my questions are – tell me about your worst gig ever.
Oh, man. It's a long story. I'll try and keep it as concise as possible.
We've got time.
I was doing a college tour, and it was three people in a van, 26 states in 4 months. Yeah. Five to seven colleges a week. Uh-huh. You were just in this van driving all over the place, and it was – and one of the guys I got along really well with, and the other guy, we plotted his murder many times. he was kind of in charge, and he was nuts.
God.
Yeah, and so we're on this college tour, and it was really awful. It was just you had to do an hour stand-up show, mm-hmm. and then you did like this game show, this make me laugh game show, where yeah. you would get students to come up one at a time, and you would have 2 minutes to try and make them laugh. And so we had a trunk of props, and we had to come up with characters and silly things to try and make them laugh. And, oh, it was terrible.
Everything you say just gets hackier and hackier.
Telling you.
And for college kids, that you can't do that.
And this is 6 months out of my quitting my day job. So this is like, you know, and it was like, wow, 4 months of work, you know, getting paid every week. That's awesome, you know. And Yeah, I mean, it was really a learning experience. I mean, even the good shows were weird because you'd be in these nighttime shows in the theaters and they were great audiences for that first hour. And then you go, all right, I got to go put a wig on. You know, I got to go come back out and, you know, do some silly thing. And then after 2 minutes, a bell would ring. And then, you know, if they got through all three comics, they got a T-shirt.
Yeah. Right? Hey, how'd you do? Did you maybe really make them laugh?
Sometimes. But you know what? I didn't care. It wasn't like because I got paid either way. Right. So it wasn't like I was, it's not like I didn't want them to win a T-shirt. Like it's not my T-shirts. I'm not paying for them. Yeah. You know? So, you know, and college is going to be, you know, the nooners were terrible. They, you know, basically 90% of nooners, because you're in a cafeteria, they're all eating lunch or studying, getting ready for their test coming up. Like, and you're up there trying to do a show and then like doing wig stuff with them, you know. And anyway, so we go to Baylor in Waco, Texas, and they had us in this tent because they were having this Renaissance event with a comedy show in it.
Ye olde comedy show.
Yes, exactly.
Geez. You're not comedians, you're jousters at that point.
Well, they had horse jousting, like the guys with the big sticks, and one arena, and that would happen every like half hour, and they would joust for like 15 minutes. And then they had another booth. Like, they were all the Renaissance people had it all timed out that you would go watch the jousting. Then you would go watch the one where they do the sword and the shield. And if a guy hit a guy in the leg, he had to go down to his knee and not use that leg or whatever. You know what I mean? And then they had another thing here. And so the students would just shuffle between the three things.
Yeah.
And then there was one tent with a guy with these falcons. He was a falconer. And they put us in the falcon tent.
Oh, God.
And the guy was so mad because his falcons, it's so loud. Your sound system is so, my falcons are angry. And he went in the back to our soundboard and started turning buttons. We're like, hey, what are you doing? Like, jeez. My falcons, you're really annoying the falcons. Really? Because they're just sitting there. They're sitting there. And every once in a while, I'll see a wing move. But, you know, well, you have to turn this down. And it was just, so it was this terrible gig. So nobody was coming to when the showtime was supposed to be because they all had this sort of Renaissance fair timing that the Renaissance people do all the time. They know how to do it, right?
Yeah.
So nobody's coming over. So they start forcing their friends to come to the show.
Yeah.
Middle of the day, the friends, no, I want to see the guys with the swords and the horses and the jousting. Well, no, come watch. We have a comedy show here. So you can win a T-shirt. So we've got
You can't win a T-shirt at jousting. Come on.
So we've got this angry audience. The show delays for 2 hours because they can't get more than the four kids to stay. They'll come and they'll stand around for a while. Then they go back over to the jousting, right?
Yeah.
So finally they get about 12 kids to stay, and we do a show, and it was horrible. And me and the one guy I liked, we told the third guy, look, we're not doing an hour. I'm going to do about 10 minutes. George's going to do about 15, and whatever you want to do is fine, but we're not all doing 20. This is silly.
Yeah.
And so we go up, and they're staring. They hate us. They just hate us, right? And then so one of the third guy who was on the show, he's up there, and he was going, well, he goes, well, we're going to stick around because right after this, we're going to do a game show and you can win a T-shirt and there'll be more comedy and everything. And this one kid goes, is it going to be as bad as what we just watched?
Oh, God.
So that's one thing about that tour. Even if you had a bad show, you're not going home. You got a game show to do now. Oh, it was, and so it was heart wrenching. And yes, so the game show was just terrible. And this one guy, you know, big football player dude, he just goes, and you just know, I'm not making him laugh. And he comes up and he sits down, and the third guy on our tour is trying to do the regular interview that we normally, like, he tries to do a comedy interview, like, hey, so what do you major in? And he tries to make a joke about it.
Yeah.
And he tries to do that. This big football player guy just sits down and he goes, oh, what's your name? Paul. Paul, what do you major in? Like, just give me the shirt now. I'm not going to laugh at you people. It was horrifying, right? So it really got to the point where when that Paul guy, I came out, I brought a chair and a newspaper. And I sat down, I started reading the newspaper. And I just sat there and read the newspaper, and Paul's just staring at me. And Andre's, he sticks his head and he goes, do something, do some jokes, do something. And I go, no. And I just sat there reading my newspaper. Ding, 2 minutes later, I got up, I took the chair, I moved back, right? And so the third guy who's a mandatory, he's so mad at me. He goes, why aren't you doing comedy? I go, because this isn't comedy. These are 12 students who hate us who are trying to get free shirts. This is a falconer who keeps coming over and turning our sound system down. This isn't comedy. I was so mad. And so
that's so funny, but so sad.
Yeah. So George, the other guy who I totally got along really well with, he was he's this 5'4" New York Italian, grew up in Brooklyn, and just had that Italian attitude. Plus, he's 5'4", so he's gotten a lot of fights growing up. He's always short.
Yeah.
So he just went out there, and after I did my newspaper thing, he went out there. And he started singing the national anthem. He just started, didn't even look at the contestant, didn't even look at Paul. He just sat there, and like halfway through he stops and he goes, "Don't you people stand for the national anthem?" And I said, "Where'd you come up with that idea?" And he goes, "Ah, I was trying to piss off the Falcons."
Yeah, after a while, you just can't take that serious.
Oh, you can't. And that was really the breaking point of me. That was about almost 3 months. So we had like a month left, and I'm just going, am I walking home from this? Am I just going to turn around and say, I made a bad decision? I'm going to go back to my day job and apologize. Yeah. But I'll tell you, the great thing in hindsight of this tour, because that was the worst gig of the tour, the Falcons and the Renaissance. Ugh. The hindsight was beautiful. It was a gift because now I came back to Tribble Runs and I was going, wow, they're all sitting down. This is awesome. Yeah. They're all in chairs, because we played some hallways where kids are walking by between classes as you. Yes.
Hallways. Who is the person that sets that up?
We were following this girl, and she goes, what about right here? And I said, oh, this room right here, because there was a classroom door. And she goes, no, nobody's going to see you in there, here. And I went, right here in the hallway? She goes, yeah, classes are going to get out soon. There's going to be a ton of people walking through here. Like, just when have you gone to a comedy show where people
dance,
are walking
monkey,
through?
Dance. Yes,
exactly.
God.
Exactly. And it was idiotic. And so it was funny because the perspective of it, the perspective of having Tribble gigs looked like, oh, wait, the room's dark. There's a microphone. I'm not in a hallway. People are, and there are people in the audience who actually pay bills for a living. Mm-hmm. So they might have some context as to appreciating what we do, you know? And so it really, in a weird way, helped me because it made one-nighters a lot less hell gig-ish.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I'm kind of glad I did it, but man, I would never do that again.
Yeah, there's a lot of comedians when they do college tours, that's usually their story.
Oh.
Like their worst gigs is usually on a college tour. And it's not like when you're actually, if you're in like a hall or something like that, where, students are sitting and watching the show. Sure, you may not get laughs, but it's better than being in a cafeteria where you're competing with the sound of forks scraping against plates
and
people walking right in front of you. And
like I said, study groups right there, like a table right there. And you see four people with books open, getting ready for a test. And all of a sudden you come up there and blah, blah, blah. One time although this gave me a great perspective too, I was doing one of those bad gigs. And the good thing in their defense, they had set up about 30 chairs right in front of the stage that weren't at tables, like chairs just facing. Hopefully that people come actually watch a show. Yeah. Now, most of the people came to those chairs were the student government, the people putting on the show, right? And a couple of their friends. But there was this one woman, it was a community college, and there was this one woman who at the time, I think I was probably 28 or so, and she was older than me. She was in her 30s and went back to community college. Mm-hmm. And so she came to watch, which I really appreciated. And so I was making jokes about how bad the show was and everything. And so somehow she and I got in a conversation while I'm on stage. And she goes, "Where did you say you went to college?" I said, "University of Washington." She goes, "Can I ask you something?" I said, "Yeah, what?" And she goes, "Did you guys have comedians there?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, like this during the day? And I said, yeah. And she goes, "How'd you treat them?"
Oh,
wow.
Interesting.
I didn't sit down at the chair and watch them.
Yeah.
I walked by and looked at them for a while, and I did exactly what I was complaining about.
Yeah.
And man, I just went Touche.
Yeah.
I'm not going to mention that again. And I never mentioned how bad the show was again. I just started doing jokes. It really, that taught me everything. Like, you know what? This is what we do at college. This is how we function. Yeah. This is our cafeteria. This isn't our, where we go to see comedy.
Yeah.
It's where we come to chat with our friends and eat and study.
Well, what time of the year were you doing this? Because I hear a lot of stories about how, like the worst one I've heard, I can't remember who it was, but they said that it was a last minute gig at a college and it was during finals week. And since it was last minute, they didn't have time to advertise. Yep. So they told them to just like stand in the hallway and just kind of do comedy and be like, okay, well, then tell them about the show that we're doing later tonight. And it was just the worst thing ever. Like, well, kids are like carrying like huge backpacks, like crying between classes.
This is the worst time. Absolutely.
All of them have bags under their eyes.
But you see, what happens is, and I don't know if it still happens this way, back when I was doing a lot of colleges, if you didn't spend your budget, you wouldn't get it next year.
Yeah.
So the idea was to spend your budget.
Yeah.
So they would book shows and do events and have movies and you know, the sumo wrestling outfits and do all kinds of stuff throughout the year, and then go, oh no, we have $400 left.
Yeah.
Right? Well, $400 isn't going to buy you like a big headliner or anything like that. So they'll call an agent and they said, well, we have this comic out of Seattle. He can do it for $400 because he could drive there and blah, blah, blah. Yes, let's get him. And then you literally get an email or a call saying, are you available next week, Thursday, for a noon gig in blah, blah, blah?
Yeah.
Because they need to spend this money. And so you go there and it's, you know, it's for, and now granted, you know, $400 is a good amount of money.
Yeah.
But everything you said is true. They're done. Their year is done. They booked their year. You are purely a way to launder out the rest of their cash, you know, like, and so finals, the people are uptight. They're angry. They're frustrated. They're not thinking comedy.
Yeah.
They're not, you know, and even the people who book you, who normally are very energetic about your show.
All week long, there's been about a 12 hours of sleep, like collectively among all of the students.
Right. Hopped up on Red Bull and just eating crap. So their stomachs are just turning, you know, and like I said, even the people who booked you, who are normally, they have posters of you all over the place and they're, you know, even they're in finals too. So even they're kind of like, oh, hey, welcome. You know, we're going to start about noon and then they walk
it's
away.
It's really great that I could schedule you. I'm not going to be able to make it because I have finals.
Well, yeah.
But I'm hoping that people will show up.
And you're sitting there in a cafeteria for a half an hour with nobody. And usually there's somebody there to chat with you. Yeah. Nobody.
Yeah.
And then, you know, more of the tables are study tables than you ever see the rest of the year, right? They're all groups of people just cramming. And it is the worst. And the money's lower because it's just extra money, you know? So they have to spend it. And comedian is an easy, cheap way to get it done. Because with a band, they have to figure out all the logistics of, you know, setting up the band.
Yeah.
Whereas a comedian, we could have the comedian here next week.
Yeah.
We'll set up one microphone and we'll get to spend that rest
of
the
month. If you're lucky enough, you have a microphone.
Well, generally you do have a mic. Colleges are usually set up to have audio. Yeah. That's one thing I've noticed, and you rarely do have something without audio. You know, colleges, people speak all the time. Mm-hmm. So they do have those normally. Okay. But you're literally a money launderer. They need to get this money out of the
account. They didn't get you because they thought you were funny.
No.
They got you because you would do it.
They called an agent. What do you have for this much money next week, Thursday?
Oh, they're not coming down the list. They're going up the list.
That's exactly.
Yeah.
They're starting from the barrel and then just kind of working their way up.
Just on your way there, you feel so special about it.
You know, well, the first time you don't realize it. The first time you have no clue.
Oh, yeah. Your agent calls you. Hey, I got you a gig.
Next week.
It's at a college, right? Yeah.
And even if you have a night gig, you can still do this because it's at noon.
Exactly. Like, everything will work out.
But then all those factors that you mentioned that the other comic said, you go, oh, this is the worst time to be here.
Yeah.
This is finals week, you know?
God.
Yeah. But I learned later on that it's because they have to spend the money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, next question.
Okay.
Turn it around here. What is the best gig you've ever had?
Well, this one wasn't really a gig, but, you know, certainly when I did the Great American Comedy Festival a couple of years ago, and not just because I won it, that was amazing. And I was hoping to make the finals. That was like a stretch of a goal, and I wound up winning it.
Yeah.
And but it's such a well run festival. They make you feel so welcome. Mm-hmm. And you're around all these talented comics who I didn't know from all over the country. And it was such a great time, man. And we just had so much fun. And then as far as, you know, gigs, you know, when I tour with Brian Regan, those are amazing gigs. Mm-hmm. because you know something about the audience, right? I know what kind of comedy they like, and I mean they're willing to spend $40 a ticket, so I know this audience.
Yeah.
And that's an amazing thing to know who your audience is before you even say a joke. Mm-hmm. And he packs out theaters, and they're such fun audiences, and he's such a great guy. He's a really nice human being and truly funny. His work ethic is impressive. Mm-hmm. So to watch his process, to watch how he goes through professionally as a comic is amazing. And then also to be in front of those audiences is amazing. And so I would say those, I mean, doing theaters, a bunch of nights in a row.
Yeah.
It's a pretty profound thing to do in comedy.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, let's go. I want to go back to the beginning of that. How did you start opening for Brian Regan?
I had worked with him years ago one time when he did a club in Seattle, and I still have my day job, and I featured for him. Then I didn't see him for 17 years, and I got really lucky. There was I got a call on a Tuesday from a guy at Live Nation, and he said, are you available, and are you busy Saturday? And I didn't have a gig on Saturday, which is really weird because I almost always do.
Yeah.
And he said, did you know Brian Regan's in town? I said, yeah. And I was aware that he was going to be there, and he was doing an outdoor venue. Mm-hmm. And they sort of realized that the sun in Seattle goes down at like, you know, 9:30 at night in July. So Brian was trying to figure out how to make the show get a little closer to the darkness, right?
Yeah.
So that he wasn't out in like bright sunlight. And somehow my name came up and they called, and he was the guy who called me was really like, you know, now I hate to censor comics, but you really have to be clean. You know, that people bring their kids to Brian's shows and it's really important. And I said, no, I understand. He goes, you know, I hate doing that. I don't like censoring comics, but it just has to be, you know, even though you're only doing 10 minutes, it has to be squeaky clean. And I said, look, first of all, I definitely work clean and I can do this. I said, second of all, if I were to lie to you and tell you I could do this and I can't, I would be pissing off Live Nation.
Yeah.
And I go to that, and that would guarantee I'd never work a comedy concert again. Right? Yeah. So I said, I promise you I can do this. And so that's how it happened. I went out and did the gig, and I did like 10 minutes and hadn't seen Brian in 17 years. And, you know, we were talking about kids and family, and he has two kids and I have two kids, and had a great conversation. And he was so genuine and so nice, and I had a great time. And then he, about 3 weeks later, I got an email from his manager saying, Brian would like to invite you on the tour. And so,
wow.
Yeah. So there's about four or five of us that he uses, different regions in the country. Yeah. I'm lucky enough to be one of them. It's a blast.
That's so cool.
Yeah. They're amazing gigs.
How often do you do it?
I'd say about, maybe every other month or every couple of months, or, you know, so.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, and it's really great. And like I said, he's a genuinely nice guy, just as well as being hilariously funny. Mm-hmm. He's one of the nicest people I've ever met, you know, comics or civilians. He's like one of the nicest human beings I've ever met.
And, well, I guess my next question, I'm assuming this would be a Brian Regan gig. What is the largest audience you've ever had?
No, the largest audience I've had was, oh wait, maybe it was the Regan one. I did one with Brian for, it had about 4,000 people.
Oh wow.
Which in total was the biggest gig because it was three nights. He sold out a 4,000 seat amphitheater for three nights.
Holy,
can you imagine?
God.
I can't imagine that.
That is ridiculous.
And then,
where was it?
Salt Lake City, just south of Salt Lake City.
Okay. Oh God. Well, yeah. In Salt Lake City, I'm sure they eat up.
He's huge there.
Yeah.
Brian is a bona fide celebrity in Utah. They love him. And so, and then, but then it was another time I opened for, I opened for a band called Lone Star.
Oh, I know Lone Star. Yeah.
Yeah. And they got some pretty good crowds at that time.
Yeah.
So this was a while back, but, yeah, man, I think there was about 5,000 in that show or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is crazy. Like, you really have to slow down because the jokes have to get to everybody and then their laughter has to come back to you. So you really have to take your time. Mm-hmm. But there's such a blast. It's a blast to do that. Because then you realize, man, if half the people laugh, that's 2,500 people.
Yeah. God. You see, I never thought about that before.
Yeah.
I'm usually in small clubs where I'm hoping that everybody laughs.
Does, yes.
Because if you only get half the people, that's only like 10 people.
Exactly.
And, of course, when you're in a venue that big, half the people is 1,000. Oh,
yeah. 2,500 people if I only get half of them.
God.
Right? And at that point in my career, I got to think I can get half the people,
yeah.
Right? So, and then when you hear 5,000 people absolutely crack up at a joke, yeah. it's like a wave. It's like water hitting you. You know?
And does that? I feel like that would be something that would go to my head. I mean, when I can get a club of 50 to 60 people all laugh at a joke, I'm like, yes, I'm successful. I'm a comedian.
Yeah, it does. It does. It's exciting and awesome. And but I'll tell you, you know, comedy is a beautiful sine curve. Comedy will bring you back really quickly. I did, you know, a few weeks ago, I did some gigs with Brian, and we did like the Toyota Center in Kennewick, this big hockey arena and a huge theater, beautiful theater in Spokane. And just, we did all these great gigs. And I'm not kidding. 3 days later, I'm doing this bar gig I can't remember where it was. Anyway, it was like this pool hall bar. And it was about 12 people, and they were really nice 12 people. They were a lot of fun for 12, but it's 12 people in a pool hall bar. And all of a sudden, this woman comes walking in with this huge thing of roses. And without ever acknowledging my existence, goes up to every one of the 12 people. Would you like to buy a rose? Would you like to buy a rose? Never even looked at me. And so I stopped talking, right? And I didn't want to make fun of her because she's doing her job.
Yeah.
She's just trying to make a buck, you know? So who am I? And this isn't like, if she did it in a comedy club, I'd be all over it.
Oh, yeah.
But in a pool hall, she comes in here every night at 9, whatever time it was, and sells roses. That's what she does. So I'm not, but I couldn't do jokes. So I literally stopped and let her go to every doll. And people were looking at me just, and they were laughing, but they had this sort of compassion for me. And so I let her do her thing. Nobody bought a rose, and then she walked out. And I said,
should have bought a rose.
Wouldn't that be funny if I did?
Yes.
But if she had looked at me, I would have probably engaged somehow, right? Yep. And maybe even bought a rose.
Do a little advertising.
Right. But she did not acknowledge I existed. And so she's going through dozen rounds. And when she leaves, I said, well, I've been in comedy 21 years, and I thought I saw every awkward thing that could happen to me on stage. That was bizarre. And they cracked up. And I started making some jokes about just not her, but the situation of it, right? And this is, I'm not kidding, 3 days after Brian and I did the gigs, you know, or I did
thousands
the gigs with Brian.
Of people.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
yeah,
so comedy is a way of like, you get so excited, like, man, I just killed in front of a theater full of people. And then 3 days later, she's selling roses without even looking at you.
Yeah. So was there any sort of like depression or withdrawals or something like that going from thousands of people to 12 people and then having to stop in the middle of it so I could sell roses?
I've been in it long enough to where I'm okay.
Yeah.
You learn that if in order to really last a while, you kind of have to keep the highs and lows sort of a little closer. I mean, you should still enjoy the highs, and you should still actually in the lows, you should feel it because it makes you work harder, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a bad show, you should feel it. But by the time I go to bed, that's gone. Whether it's a great show or a bad show, by the time I go to bed, I like to just leave it there because it's time to look at it as a comedian, as a businessman. What do I have to do? If it was a bad show, what could I have done better? You know, what could I have, you know, or this joke I'm working on, how I need to change it. And you get more looking at it as a business because you realize if you hold those highs, then the lows will hit you, right? I mean, if I got so to the point, like I just had a great week, Brian complimented my new stuff. He said he loves working with me. If I had really held on to that too much, then on the Rose night, I would have been pissed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I would have been just like, I deserve better than this. Like, well, no, you don't. You took the gig.
Well, you know what I mean? And it's kind of like the college thing where in your mind, all you're thinking is paycheck, 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 paycheck. Exactly. Hey, here's your t-shirt. Paycheck, 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 paycheck.
Exactly. And so if you keep that sort of perspective on it, like I said, enjoy the highs. There's great moments in comedy where you just go, but you know, whether it's playing in front of a theater full of people or a new joke that gets a really good laugh three times in a row, and you go, oh, okay, this is a good joke, and that's exciting too. So you find the excitements, you deal with the lows, you understand, okay, how do I make it so that never happens again, or at least happens a lot less.
Yeah.
And it makes it a little bit easier, you know, but yeah, if what happened a couple of weeks ago happened to me 10 years ago, I'd probably be just a mess that week. You know, like, I was at a theater and then this woman selling roses would have been so like, you know.
I'm hoping for Brian Regan. Don't you people know who I am?
I picked up 10 Twitter followers in one theater show. Like, you know, like, you can't look at it that way. But I mean, you can't help but doing it. But I think after you've been in it a while, you do have to temper that a bit.
Yeah.
You know, because ultimately, if you want to last, you have to be able to take punches and you have to be able to kind of go with it and just figure it out. You know, you can't take it too personal.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, I guess it's about appreciation of the audience, no matter what the size.
Yeah.
I mean, if it had been a crappy audience when the woman came in with the flowers, then it would have been a withdrawal situation.
Yeah, that would have hurt a lot more.
Yeah.
But they were a nice group of people and they laughed because they realized how awkward it was. And they also realized that I wasn't hacking on her. They gave me the credit that I wasn't making this about her disrupting me. It was about I'm in a place where things work differently than most comedy situations.
You're in a place where women come in with flowers.
That's right.
I
think they gave me that credit and were laughing about it, you know. And I said, towards the end of the show, I said, you know what? I said, you guys are really, really nice. I said, when the original Showtime hit, there was only three of you or five of you. And I thought, oh, this is, you know, and I said, you know, and then you became 12. And I go, and you know what? You've actually been a very nice 12. And I said, I'd like to buy you all a rose. Oh, she's gone. Right. And they just cracked up. So like you said, to be able to do a joke like that, the fact that they were a good audience made that actually kind of, you know, it was fun. All right, you know, just, and like I said, comedy is a great sine curve.
Probably the best way that situation could have worked out.
Yeah. And I think it stems from me not getting angry at that woman. Yeah. I think to understand where you are and that's one thing I think as comics, we have to understand not only where you are, but where you belong, right? So many comics think, I should be headlining, I should be this, I should be that. Yeah, maybe you should.
I should.
But you're not.
Yeah.
So do the best with what you have today.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that actually, I never thought about that. That's a better way to explain my theory of the difference between Northwest comedians and SoCal comedians. The SoCal comedians think that I should be doing this.
Right.
I should have those gigs.
Right.
As where in the Northwest, it's I'm trying to be that comedian. I'm trying to get those gigs.
That's very true.
Yeah.
That's a really good way to put it. And I think in their defense, in the SoCal comic defense, you kind of have to.
Yeah.
You kind of have to believe you belong there, right? Because those guys aren't just doing comedy. They're also doing auditions during the day. And when you go into an audition, you have to believe, I can get this, right? Whereas in comedy, you can believe that you're trying and actually still do pretty well. You know? You know? So I think for those of us in Northwest whose our lives are built mostly on just stand-up, you're right. We're trying to get better. We're trying to get more material. We're trying to get that hour.
Yeah.
And if you have an hour, I'm trying to get that second hour. I'm trying to get that third hour.
Yeah.
So, you're absolutely right. That's a great way to put it.
Well, and when you're starting out in SoCal, a majority of the beginning of your success is just getting to an open mic early enough to get on the list.
Yeah, man.
So it's, you know, you're trying harder to get on stage than you're trying on stage.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, there's not much you can do about it at this point, but it's just kind of that stigma in the back of the people of, you know, starting comedians' brains that just, they aren't... I don't know. I guess the environment just doesn't allow them to do it the way that it should.
Yeah. See, my thing is, okay, my thing is, if you believe you should be headlining or doing better gigs, that's absolutely fine. I think it's good to be motivated in comedy.
Yeah.
But I think from the moment they introduce your name to the moment you say goodnight, none of that matters.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, because if you took the gig, if you said, yeah, I'll go to the bar gig at the pool hall.
Yeah.
It's your job to do it, to do your job.
Yeah.
You don't go there and tell them, well, I normally do these gigs. And no. They don't care. They just want to be entertained. And that's the problem. When I see comics on stage acting like they somehow deserve better than you people, mm-hmm. that I hate. Because you're in front of those people. That's your audience tonight. Entertain them. And if you feel like you can't do this anymore, don't ever accept this gig again.
Yeah.
But as soon as your name is introduced, it's your job to be a comedian, not to let us know what kind of comedian or what level comedian you are.
Yeah.
You know? And so that's where I sort of draw the line. I think a lot of comics take that to the audience, and it's not on them. These people have been working all day. They just want to have a beer and have some laughs. It's nice. You know, your career isn't their issue.
Yeah.
You know?
My next question, is what is your writing process? And how has it changed over your career? Because I mean, there's some comedians that can sit down and do 8 hours of homework, 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, and write their material that way. And then there's the other end of the spectrum where you're driving in your car and you kind of giggle at something. You're like, oh, I've got to write that down. And then it just kind of sits in your notebook and you play with it later on. And
yeah, that's it. I mean, I'm more towards that. I can't sit and write. And so what I do is the idea will come and I'll have it. I'll jot down like just a phrase, mm-hmm. 2-3 words, just to remind me of the idea.
Yeah.
And then I'll try it on stage. Just throw it in there, see what happens, mm-hmm. and see if any angles jump up. Because to me, I feel like that's where my brain is most in comedy mode, is when I'm on stage.
Yeah.
I really feel like, so I'm thinking comedically.
You go up on stage with just the idea. Uh-huh. You don't try to work on the joke beforehand.
Well, usually when I think of the joke, I have some form of punchline on there, right?
But you don't try to work it out or anything. You just,
no, and I know that's weird. I know that's...
Well, no, that's not weird.
But I feel like...
That means that you're quicker on the ball and you have a better idea of what you're doing. You have more confidence.
Yeah, well, when you're on stage, I think, is when your brain is most in the mode of understanding who you are as a comic, right? Because you're on your toes, because like I'll leave the act if I'm riffing with somebody or talking about something, or if I see, or something happens in an audience that I feel like I should address. I mean, I think I did that a couple of times when I did that show here. I just kind of go over these tangents because someone said something or laughed a certain way or whatever. And so I'll do those things. So why not do that with the new stuff? Mm-hmm. And so I'll go with a basic idea and then see if I can throw a couple tags out. And then even I might even do it like 2 or 3 more times with different angles. Keep the things I like, add a different direction, like turn it here and try that angle. And then I will put it in the notebook. Then I'll write it. Then I'll jot it down and say, here's what I came up with on stage. And that might spark. I'll look at the lines that I've been saying on stage and I'll go, oh, you know what? I can add something here. And I'll try this, and, and then add from there. And then once I start to get pretty confident with the bit, then I attack the setup. Then I go, okay, how do I make the setup shorter? Because I always can. Every time you look at new material, I mean, for me, every time I look at new material, the setup is going to need months. Mm-hmm. Months, because there's so many different ways to say anything. I just joined Twitter a couple months ago, and one of the things I love about Twitter is you have to be efficient about how you set up the joke. Mm-hmm. And it's that's kind of what I try and do once I get the crux of the joke down. And then once I get the setup done, then the process from there is just adding. Because once I'm happy with the setup, now I'm just adding tags, adding punchlines, changing punchlines, maybe having alternate punchlines, coming up with a different punchline that I think some audiences might like better. Now the way it's differently from before is the writing on stage part. Because I used to write down the 2-3 word phrase and then jot down a couple sentences that I thought. Mm-hmm. But it got frustrating because those those few sentences that I wrote down when I first wrote down the phrase, they rarely ever stayed in the joke. Okay. And I started thinking, am I just not funny? Like I literally have to go to audiences like, what do you think of this? What if I said this? Very funny. Wait, but that one I just thought of just now. You know, and it would make me crazy. Like I was riffing that one line and they loved it. And that became the new angle of the joke. And so that is the main difference in my process now as before, because I started saying, well, fine, then I'm just going to write it on stage, you know, and not to say that every line I do on stage is going to work, but percentage wise, I do better creating on stage than I do. I should say initially, I do better creating on stage than I do in the notebook. And once I get a few angles from on stage, then the notebook becomes fruitful. But I was noticing that, man, when I wrote a bit, I oftentimes had it wrong. Like I was looking at the wrong part of it and why it's funny, or I was using the wrong strategy. Like I was just like I had like a simile going and it should have been an exaggeration. And in the notebook, when I first start writing about it, I go, yeah, that's really good. And the simile would eat it. Like, wow, man, I thought that was funny. And you kind of wrestle with it. And then on stage, I would say something else, like a more of a metaphor, an exaggeration, it would kill.
Yeah.
And I go, oh, okay, you know. And so I cut out that middleman. I just, all right, fine, I'm just going to write down the phrase so I don't forget about the bit.
Yeah.
But it's going on stage before I write anything down.
Interesting.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah, see, I'm the other way around, where I have to write the joke out in my notebook and then try it on stage. Because I cannot go up there with just an idea of a joke. I don't have that kind of confidence. And I feel like I could go up there and I could riff, but if I'm riffing and I don't get laughs, then I clam up and that's when like the nerves hit I can't handle that. So I have to write it out in order to get that confidence and say, okay, I think this joke is a good joke. I will do it on stage.
And believe me, the vast majority are more like you than me. I don't recommend my process at all.
Well, did you start out with this process?
Not really, no. I mean, I would write out jokes and everything. And then, like I said, I developed this process of writing out the phrase and then just a few lines and then taking it on stage and seeing what comes out of it. And that has evolved in just taking it on stage before I ever write it down. So, I don't recommend it. Believe me, most people do what you do. And plus, what you do is great because as you're creating the joke, you can actually see the setup and make the setup changes. I don't make the setup changes till I'm happy with the joke.
Yeah.
You know, unless on stage I come up with a way to say it, they go, oh, that's pretty concise. Mm-hmm. Then I'll keep it. But generally, the setup wrestling is like the third thing I do in a bit, you know. Whereas you get to actually look at it and go, oh, okay, this setup's too long. It's because it's all laid out in front of you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, believe me, man, your way is the way most people do it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, yeah, and this is why I asked that question is because I like to hear about different ways that people do it.
Yeah.
And to be able to go up there with just an idea and then afterwards, if it works out, put it down in the notebook and work it out.
Yeah.
That's brave.
Yeah, well, but it's brave to some extent, but it also is me just playing into strengths for me, right? The creative process works best for me when I'm on stage. So, and it's also another way to challenge myself, right? Mm-hmm. Because I've been around the business long enough to where, all right, if I've got to do a 45-minute set, I know I could breeze through it and think about my grocery list the whole time and still do okay.
Yeah.
And so it's a way for me to get excited because pretty soon it's going to be that point where I don't know what I'm going to say, you know, and I'm really looking forward to it. And so now I'm on my toes about the set, about comedy, about the moment. Mm-hmm. And then when I get to it, I go, all right, here we go. You know, and I'll say, so blah, 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 and start it and go. And it keeps me sort of excited, right? Which for me is, like I said, I'm intrinsically lazy and I have ADD. So it's easy for me to sort of just gloss the whole thing over. So having these moments in the show that are coming up where I'm going to be doing something where I'm not sure where the bit's going to go. Mm-hmm. Like I know one punchline I thought of, but after that, we'll see. It keeps me sort of in the set, you know, so that's a good thing.
Interesting. And my last question is what is your definition of success and where are you in relation to that?
Wow. Well, I think, you know, I think when I first started, like most comedians in our 20s, you know, you're kind of hoping to get seen and maybe get a sitcom or something big. And But you know, right now for me, and it's going to sound so hokey, I have two kids. I just want to provide for them well. You know, I want them to be set, and they're not at this point, right? So, and then I look at Brian Regan and I go, well, here's a guy who's not a household name famous. He's never had a sitcom. He's never been on a show for something other than stand up, right? Mm-hmm. He's never been on he's never been a character on anything. And so here's a guy filling theaters with people who love him just for stand up. And to me, that is a great success.
Yeah.
Great success. I mean, think of every other famous comedian out there has some kind of other thing that people know him for, right? Some kind of thing that they do. And Brian has just done it on stand-up. And that to me, he told me that he likes, he's always wanted, the idea was that he wanted to get whatever it took, a sitcom or whatever it took, in order to be able to do stand-up in theaters. Mm-hmm. And he's achieved it without that.
Yeah.
Like, that's huge.
See, I think that is the oddity of Brian Regan, because before I had any interest in comedy, no idea who Brian Regan was.
Right, right.
And this was still in a time when he was selling out theaters, like for amphitheaters a week, you know. And what was weird is that as soon as I started doing comedy, just instantly, all the other comedians, I'd, you know, ask them questions and be like, oh, yeah, well, Brian Regan this, and, you know, this other guy was doing this, and then talking about Brian Regan, and then other Brian Regan. And I was like, who the hell is Brian Regan? I've never heard this name before in my entire life.
Yeah.
And that's all people talk about. And the reason that he never came into view for me before I started doing comedy and getting into it was that he didn't do anything else.
That's right.
I mean, Seinfeld had a TV show. That's why he is one of the most well-known people, right, even outside of the comedy community. And it was the documentary I Am Comic. Have you seen that?
I've not.
No? Okay. But that was when I really understood who Brian Regan was. And it's just a quick interview with him. Right. And it just shows how important he was and how people really loved him. And I was like, where did all these people come from? Like, no civilians, I say civilians, but no civilians that I know have ever talked about Brian Regan.
Right.
Just, it's never come up. But in the comedy world, he is one of those people that comedians talk about.
Yeah.
And, well, there's three parts of fame, or not fame, of success for me. It's three F's, which is fame, finance, and friends.
Right.
And Brian Regan has all three of those.
Yeah.
I mean, any comedian can have any variation of those three things.
Right.
And with friends, it's about how much of the other comics love you. And the other comics just respect him so much because that's all he ever does. I mean, you can, like, people don't like Dane Cook because they say he's just a sellout and he's a hack. And yeah, but he also sells out 4,000-seat amphitheaters four times a week, you know? But
And he invented his thing. That's people don't realize that because a lot of comics work like him now.
Yeah.
Not many people were doing what he does back then. Those little things that comics now say they hate when they see other comics do.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was doing them, like holding the microphone that way or moving it there or doing the head thing.
Yeah.
And you know, and I knew Dane back in the day, and I remember a bunch of us were sitting around a table talking, and Dane said he was spending $15,000 to get a website, because you had to back then.
Yeah.
This was 95 or 96.
Yeah.
And we were like, what? Yeah. There's this company that'll do it, and they make your website, and people can click on a thing from the website, and it sends you emails, and you get the emails. And
wait, emails?
Yeah. We knew what email was, sort of, you know. And so he said, and then you collect email addresses, and then let them know when you're going to be in their town. And we were just like, $15,000? Really?
Yeah.
And
you can do it for free. You just have a little bit of knowledge.
But that's what I'm saying, though. When it was not financially a good idea, or when it was like it seemed so new, it was weird.
Yeah.
Now, he was right on all of this.
Yeah.
MySpace was nothing. It was just a little musicians community. And Dane was doing colleges like crazy.
Yeah.
And every college, he goes, you guys got to check out a thing called MySpace, because then you and I can send each other messages. And, you know, girls are like, I can send him messages. They're so excited.
Yeah.
So people started getting these MySpace accounts. Dane was one of the biggest reasons MySpace succeeded. need it. And so as much as everybody talks about how he's this or he's that, first of all, even if you don't like his comedy, he's really good at it. He's very good at the kind of comedy he does. Second of all, he invented it. He invented that style.
Yeah.
And you knew when you were watching it that this wasn't going to be a new way of doing comedy. This was going to run its course. And those kids who loved him at that time, as soon as they hit about 28, 29, they're not going to be as into him, right? Yeah. And he knew it too. So he branched to the next level, went to movies, made, you know.
Yeah.
And
he has the most ridiculous combination of confidence and energy that no other comic has.
Yeah.
And I think that's
incredible. And
there's a little bit of jealousy.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of jealousy.
There's a lot of jealousy. Plus, he's a good looking guy, too. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Dane Cook has 100% fame, 100% finance in the success.
Yes. But
no friends. He's pretty down low.
He's got a lot of enemies.
But it's not his fault. Most of the people try to be, non-discriminatory. And when they meet him, they're like, oh, yeah, he was a pretty nice guy. And then there's half of the people that say, yeah, he was kind of dick when I met him. And, people have emotions. They go through moods. They just met him at the wrong time or something like that. So I give him the benefit of the doubt. And it's because of jealousy of other comics for what he does by being original and having energy that no other comic has.
Yeah.
Which means that he's really the only one that can do what he does.
Yep, absolutely.
And that's why the friends thing goes down. I mean, if they could respect him for the finance and fame, then he would have more friends, but it's just that jealousy sort of thing.
Yeah.
So where do you find yourself in those three levels?
I'm a road comic. My wife works and our kids are fine. We can buy what we need and they can get Halloween costumes and play in sports leagues. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's not like we're not poor by any means, but.
Well, are you just living off of doing comedy?
Yeah. 21 years. And that's a success right there.
Yeah.
Because I didn't think it would last this long.
Yeah. Well, and see, there's a lot of comedians just starting out working a second job that says, you know what? When I can just live off of doing my comedy, I will be successful.
Absolutely. And I don't take that for granted. I completely agree. It's 21 years as my only job.
Yeah.
And I cannot complain at all. And I've gotten to see so much of this country. I've gotten to, I've got to take my family on cruise ships, which I really, I couldn't afford if we did it on our own, So I was working a cruise ship, brought the family out. That kind of thing is invaluable and it's awesome. But if I were to look at the next level, it would be, being able to play theaters.
Yeah.
Because people want to see your stand up. That to me is an awesome thing.
Yeah. And that kind of falls into the fame category also. I mean, now it's easier to measure the fame part just by Twitter followers.
Sort of a deal. Yeah. That gives you an idea.
Yeah. And before it used to be, like Dane Cook, he started out just fame. He was aiming for fame the entire time. That's why he got the website. He wanted to email people. Like, he wanted everybody to know who he was and where he was going to be performing.
Exactly.
And when you get to the point of fame where you go to a club and it's sold out and a majority of the people there are there to specifically see you.
Right.
They're like, we heard you're in town and you're performing tonight. That's why we came.
Right.
Then that is the form of success in fame.
Yeah. A couple weeks ago when I did the gigs with Regan, I was sitting in the hotel lobby the next day and this family was checking out and they saw me and they came over and they said, hey, we just want to say you had a great show. You and Brian were hilarious. And they said, and they introduced me to their son who was like 14. They said, our son's a big fan of Brian, but he really loved you as well. He's a fan of yours now. And so I shook his hand and we chatted and they had driven 3 hours and got in a hotel room. So they came into town, checked in the hotel, grabbed some dinner, went to the show, watched Brian, and the next day we're going home. And I thought, they drove 6 hours in 2 days to go see a comedian because they like that comedian.
Yeah.
I was blown away. Yeah. I couldn't believe. But that's it. There's something special about that. When you're that good, like you said, people will go see you because you're there. That's why they're going.
And does does that happen to you often? Like at the end of a show, people come up to you and say, oh, we came just to see you.
Oh, yeah. Not 3 hours.
Yeah.
But no, I do. In certain markets that I've been in a lot, I do have a certain amount of people. Nothing, you know, nothing to be able to tell a club owner that I should get a door deal or anything like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, usually,
NBC is not offering you a sitcom.
Yeah, exactly. But usually if it's a market I've been to repeatedly, there's at least a handful that come to see the shows.
Yeah.
And then when I was in Reno last month, I was there 3 months ago with Brian. And then last month I was at the club in the same hotel.
Yeah.
And Brian was so nice to mention that I was going to be back in the club,
yeah.
You know, because we were in the big huge ballroom downstairs, and so all but one show at the club in Reno, I had people come up saying, "Hey, we saw you with Brian, and you know, we came to see your headline set." And,
yeah,
and it was really awesome. So I do get that, but not on a level where, like I said, it's not going to make a difference to bookers. It's not, mm-hmm. you know, maybe someday it will, but right now it's not a huge draw that is going to make that much of a difference.
Yeah,
you know,
but it is growing. You do see it growing at a.
I feel like it is. The nice thing is, especially when you work clean, is that people will bring relatives who would never go to a comedy club to see you, mm-hmm. right? That's a nice thing. Brian gets that a lot. People, you know, and so I have people come up to me going, you know, I brought my mom and she would never come to comedy clubs because they're always so dirty or whatever.
Yeah.
And we wanted her to see you, you know, whatever. So, so you do build on the clean thing, but then there's also people that just kind of really like what I do, you know? Mm-hmm. But like I said, not a ton, but they're there.
Yeah. Well, and I guess, well, I'm going to draw this out. That was supposed to be my last question, but I'm going to ask one more that kind of ties into it is, from your definition, based on those three parts, do you feel that you are successful right now?
Yeah, I certainly feel like I'm successful because I never thought this would go this long. Mm-hmm. I never thought I'd make a living at it for this long. I've got some pretty decent credits over the years. I've performed in 47 states. That's a pretty amazing thing to think.
Yeah.
You know, that I performed in all but three states in this country. That's pretty amazing. I've seen different countries. You know, I was lucky enough to do some shows in Hong Kong a few months ago.
And oh, wow.
Yeah, I got paid to go to Hong Kong.
That's pretty cool.
Amazing. So yes, I do. And like I just said, there's a handful out there that like what I do and come and see me. And mm-hmm. And so, yes, I do feel like I'm a success. And on the three parts, you know, I'm at a fraction of all three parts. Like even when you say comedy friends, I know a lot of comedians like me as a person. I get along with a lot of comics and I consider a lot of them, you know, good friends. And but I also know that I'm not the kind of act that comedians really go nuts over, you know what I mean? Like I get it. I totally understand.
Yeah.
But every once in a while I'll have comics are a little more edgier tell me, hey, I like that joke you do or whatever. And so yeah, I feel like I have a certain amount of respect in the comedy community, but I do think a part of it is just off stage is that, you know, in getting along with people, I like to think I treat comics with respect. And, so I mean, I think in all three things you mentioned, you know, I've got a piece of each, mm-hmm. but not, you know, not anywhere. Like when you say one part of it is fame, that's the wrong word to use with me.
Yeah.
But I've got some of a following, you know, there and I've been on a couple TV things. So it's not like I haven't done anything in that category, mm-hmm. but yeah. So I'd say I have enough of a percentage of each of those three categories to say that I'm pretty happy. I mean, I want it to keep growing and I want it to expand, but, I gotta say I'm pretty happy with it.
And well, can you pinpoint a time in your career where you're like, this is it. I am officially on the path to being successful.
I thought, you know, I got accepted to the Aspen Comedy Festival in 98. Mm-hmm. And that was back when HBO was running it. And when I got accepted to it, I thought, wow. And I got one of the last spots. Like, they were almost fully booked.
Yeah.
And they brought me in for it. And I thought that was it. I really thought this was going to be the movement. But the great thing about it, because it didn't happen, but... there were these amazing comics that were on their way. I mean, on their way to big things. Mm-hmm. And there were big time celebrities hanging out. It was really amazing to be a part of that. And, But what I did learn from it is, okay, what was the difference? Like, I wasn't horrible that week, but it was obvious I wasn't one of those that were in the same groups as me and everything. And what I realized is I need to work on stand-up. Forget all this trying to be big in L.A. and because you're not going anywhere if you don't have a character, if you don't have a voice. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of focused on stand-up. Now, that's partly to my detriment because I should have been still going down to L.A. a couple times a year just to show my face. Mm-hmm. But my thing was like, no, I'm not going to show L.A. till I'm ready to go. And what you realize is you're never really ready to go. Eventually you just have to make the move and know that you have enough now to at least be seen. Mm-hmm. And I should have done that more. But I really thought in 98 this was going to be it. And it wasn't it, but it did teach me, okay, get better at stand-up and let everything play out, mm-hmm. play out how it's going to play out. And so I'm glad I did it because I really feel like from 98 to now I've improved a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I've become a lot more of who I am on stage and, you know, believe a lot more in the process of what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't have happened if I didn't get into that 98. So it wasn't easy to take at the time because I really thought I'm going to have a manager by Sunday. I'm going to have an agent.
Yeah.
No, I didn't.
It wasn't quite Johnny Carson show.
I did get the Louis Anderson show, the comedy showcase that was on at the time. I got that from Aspen. And I did get some industry people who, I've kind of kept in touch with, but none of them like, I'm going to make your career, you know, nothing like that. Just people I know now and, you know, kind of kept in touch with. Yeah. So in that way it was good. And then how it made me refocus on stand up was invaluable. That was a huge lesson for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's neat.
Yeah.
Well, it's been so much fun sitting here and talking to you.
Thanks. I feel like I was rambly.
No, that's okay. I usually have a co-host to ask more questions. but everybody was either out of town or doing whatever. And this was actually last minute because you just happened to be in town.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, this has been so much fun. Just working with you last week and then hanging out with you last night and talking was just, it's been a really good time.
I enjoyed it as well, Ryan. Thanks, man.
Twitter?
Just my name, Kermit Apio with it's an E. It's KERMETAPIO.
At Kermit Apio.
Yeah, at Kermit Apio.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. That's been great. Thank you, Kermit, for being here.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.